It's a pleasure to be here. I'm in West Marin. Janine and I are from the Colorado Plateau, the Four Corners area, and we're really, really fortunate to live in a place that still has a lot of its wildness intact. The great labyrinth of canyon country that we'd love to get lost in. In fact, just got lost there a week or two ago for 5 days. At a place we call Laughing Goddess Canyon. And we also love to come here to West Marin. There's a kind of wildness here still intact that is very inspiring and somewhat disorienting for us because there's such a profusion of green here. And then there's this that really wild creature called the Pacific here as well. Let's see, I want to dedicate this talk to the same thing we've dedicated all our work at Animas Valley Institute, which is a dedication to cultural change, which is so urgent. I suppose we all know that, how urgent it is that there is some kind of transformation in culture, a renaissance, some would say a repair of our Western cultures. And that's what's most important to us in our work. That we primarily think of ourselves at Animas Valley Institute as agents of cultural renaissance or cultural evolution. How many people here have hoped at one time or another, maybe in the middle of the night, that there's something you could do to save the world? I mean, in your worst moments, you thought maybe it was really up to you. Because I've had those moments, and it's somewhat misguided and arrogant. But we want to do what we can, and I think we've all probably realized that we can't save the world single-handedly. And maybe the world isn't even something that is needing to be saved exactly. But there's an opportunity for each one of us to participate in the world in the way that we each were uniquely meant to belong to the world. And that's what our work is, as we call ourselves at Animas nature-based underworld guides. There's something a little menacing about the term. We kind of like underworld guides. But that's why we do the work we do, is to help support everybody, people like you, to become the most effective visionary artisans of cultural change that we're each capable of being and becoming. Janine likes to remind me that every life matters. Every life matters. each one of our lives matters, and each one of us has been born to play a particular part in these extraordinary times. So that's the dedication. And I want to start with a poem, partly with the intention of shifting consciousness. Not to imply there's anything wrong with our consciousness right now, but shifting our consciousness is kind of like triangulates the world, that we get to see, experience life and the world and ourselves from different perspectives. Kind of side by side. And by shifting our consciousness a little bit, our minds can be open to feelings, ideas, and images that are outside the mainstream. And if something's going to help us as agents of cultural change, we need to look at things a little bit differently. So that's actually what I hope to do tonight is help shift our perspective a little bit. Good poetry is one of the things we have as humans to shift consciousness. And actually, both nature and the human psyche has given us so many techniques, strategies, methods, technologies for shifting consciousness in a way that is helps us participate more fully in the world. So it may very well be the case that shifting consciousness is key to engendering a wild mind, or a wilder mind. So this poem that I want to start with, there'll be two or three poems tonight, and none of them are in any of the books, any of my books, so this is like an extra you get from being here tonight. And this first poem is a piece by the British-American poet David White. And it's called All the True Vows. In this poem, there are two truths mentioned near the beginning. So keep your ears and hearts and souls open to these two truths. It turns out these two truths are two ways to speak of the same truth, which might seem puzzling at first. But that's, again, how our consciousness gets shifted by some puzzles. And then towards the end of the poem, there the poet refers to two promises. And these are not two versions of the same promise. These are very different kinds of promises. And in fact, if you make one of them, you can't make the other one. Is actually impossible. So you might tune in to two truths near the beginning, two promises near the end. Okay, all the true vows. All the true vows are secret vows. The ones we speak out loud are the ones we break. All the true vows are secret vows. The ones we speak out loud are the ones we break. There's only one life you can call your own, and 1,000 others you can call by any name you want. There's only one life you can call your own, and 1,000 others you can call by any name you want. Hold to the truth you make every day with your own body. Hold to your own truth at the center of the image you were born with. Those who do not understand their destiny will never understand the friends they have made, nor the work they have chosen, nor the one life that waits beyond all the others. By the lake, in the wood, in the shadows, you can whisper that truth to the quiet reflection you see in the water. Okay, now if I step over here, I'm moving outside the poem for a second. This is a quick quiz. Do you know which truth he was talking about? You can whisper that truth to the quiet reflection you see in the water. It's the truth you make every day with your own body, or the truth at the center of the image you were born with. By the lake, in the wood, in the shadows, you can whisper that truth to the quiet reflection you see in the water. Whatever you hear from the water, remember it wants you to carry the sound of its truth on your lips. Remember, whatever you hear from the water, whatever you hear from the water, remember it wants you to carry the sound of its truth on your lips. Remember, in this place, which place? By the lake, in the wood, in the shadows. Remember, in this place, no one can hear you. And out of the silence, you can make a promise it will kill you to break. That way you'll find what's real and what is not. I know what I'm saying. Time almost forsook me, and I looked again. Seeing my reflection, I broke a promise and spoke for the first time after all these years in my own voice. Before it was too late, to turn my face again. All the true vows are secret vows. The ones we speak out loud are the ones we break. There's only one life you can call your own, and 1,000 others you can call by any name you want. Hold to the truth you make every day with your own body. Don't turn your face away. Hold to your own truth at the center of the image you were born with. Those who do not understand their destiny will never understand the friends they have made, nor the work they have chosen, nor the one life that waits beyond all the others. By the lake, in the wood, in the shadows, you can whisper that truth to the quiet reflection you see in the water. Whatever you hear from the water, remember, it wants you to carry the sound of its truth on your lips. Remember, in this place, no one can hear you, and out of the silence, you can make a promise it will kill you to break. That way you'll find what is real and what is not. I know what I'm saying. Time almost forsook me, and I looked again. Seeing my reflection, I broke a promise and spoke for the first time after all these years in my own voice. Before it was too late to turn my face again. So what an illuminating shock it must be to realize one day that you actually haven't been speaking in your own voice, because we assume we are speaking in our own voice. Well, whose voice? It's my voice. But we realize one day, we might come to realize one day, no, actually we haven't. I haven't been speaking in my own voice. Maybe it's been decades since I've spoken in my own true voice. Perhaps not since I was a small child. You realize, perhaps, that whatever dance you've been doing in life, it isn't your own true dance. You've been dancing to a tune you learned from someone else, or that you learned in school or at church, or perhaps a dance you made up yourself, but it still wasn't really yours. It's been a survival dance, you realize, and it's good to have a survival dance, but it hasn't been your sacred dance. So it's such an immense turning point in life when this happens for you, when you realize that you have to break that promise that we all make when we're kids, when we're little kids. And we made it when we were so young, we don't even remember having made it. But we know that we made it. And the promise we made was that I will not sing. I will not sing in my own true voice because I get into too much trouble when I do. It doesn't allow me to fit in well enough. And so in order to survive, we make a pact. We make a bargain. And we say, I'm willing to stop singing if I get basic psychological safety. And so when we get to that point in life, when we break that promise, we make the promise that it would kill us to break. That first promise, it would kill us not to break at some point. But and later, we make a promise it will kill us to break, and we begin to speak in our own true voice, in our original voice, in our wild voice. So this idea that there are these two truths, that there are truths, the truths of body and soul, the truth we make every day with our own body, and the truth that's at the center of the image we were born with, these are kind of surprising or odd or unfamiliar, at least, ideas in contemporary Western world, that there are those kinds of truths. I didn't learn about that in school. I don't know about you. But it's an understanding that's common to people in healthy cultures all over the world, and including our own Western mystery traditions. There's the truth of body and soul. We use that term all the time, even in contemporary advertising, body and soul. But we've we don't really know. In the contemporary Western world, we've forgotten what it's actually referring to. And it's a mysterious thing that with our own bodies, every day, we're making some truth we might not even know about. And then there's this, to me, even more mysterious idea that we are each born with an image, a particular image, an image that's unique to us, a symbolic, mysterious, particular image. At least that's one way to say it. And there's a truth at the center of that image. And that truth has everything to do with what our life is about and everything to do with how we are uniquely designed to participate in the world. And it has everything to do with how we can most contribute to cultural transformation. In the mainstream Western societies, not everyone ends up ever discovering this double truth, this body and soul truth. In fact, my guesstimate is about 10% of people ever discover it, because our Western societies are designed in such a way, in some ways deliberately, so that we won't discover that. Because every day, what you might think of as consumer society or dominator society, industrial growth society, depends on people not discovering those truths. It's a hard nut to swallow that Western culture might have wandered so far from what is healthy, and which makes it difficult for us to become fully human. But it's still possible. So, what we've been doing for 30 years now at Animus Valley Institute is step by step, really slowly, and making all kinds of horrendous mistakes, one step at a time, we've been inventing a contemporary Western approach to what can be called, we call, the process of soul initiation, the process of being initiated into our soul lives. And drawing as much as we can on Western traditions, but also on other universal patterns we find in healthy cultures all over the world. And we've been doing this work, I like to say, with an equal measure of innocence and chutzpah, and also with an equal measure of grief and longing, a grief for the loss of these traditions, initiatory traditions, in the Western world that we lost hundreds of years ago, some would say thousands, 5,000 or more years ago. And I'm often reminded to remind people that the Western culture is not the only culture that forgot. That it seems that at least half of human cultures end up forgetting. And that has everything to do with what it is to be human and our particular kind of liability. We might even say the sacred wound of our species, as my partner Janine refers to it, the sacred wound of our human consciousness. We tend to forget. That's a whole other story. So the goal of the process of soul initiation is to discover what at Animus we refer to as our mythopoetic identity. Mythopoetic identity. And this is something, that's another phrase for our soul, S-O-U-L, identity. It's the identity that is rooted in that double truth, that body and soul truth. And it's an identity that's much deeper than personality. It's much deeper than social role or job. It's an identity revealed in and expressed through symbol and metaphor, image and dream, myth and archetype. And again, this is something that they forgot to tell us about in the Western world, that we have an identity that has nothing to do directly with culture or with language or with how we or the social roles we have or the jobs we have. It's something much deeper. And you could say it's our ecocentric identity. It's the identity that we were born into It's the place in nature, the role in nature that we were born to live in. And in healthy cultures, there are technologies, ceremonies, practices to help people discover this. And it's really actually not that hard to do it. Okay, here's a couple examples. One of my favorite examples is one of my teachers, and she's a lot of people's teachers, including a lot of you here, Joanna Macy. How many people know of Joanna's work? How many people read her autobiography called Widening Circles? Okay, so you'll know this story. Or if you read Nature and the Human Soul, the story's in there. For those of you who don't know Joanna, she's a Buddhist scholar, an eco-philosopher. She's an activist in various fields, nuclear, environmental, and so on. For many, many years, she's, 83 or 84 now, going strong, a remarkable teacher for so many, an author of many books. Did I say she's a Buddhist scholar? Yes, I did. In her autobiography, I found what seemed to be very clear evidence, and she ended up agreeing with me, of two encounters with soul, or soul encounters. She had at least two in her life so far, and she writes about them very beautifully in her book. And one of them, the easier one to speak of, was I believe she was 38, somewhere around there, late 30s. She was living in India with her husband and children, and she was beginning to get serious about her Buddhist practice, and she had a teacher in India in contemplative practice. And she really, I guess you'd say, threw herself into her practice. And in doing that, it disoriented her sense of self, as we would hope it would do, or you might say it's designed to do. And she became, she didn't put it this way, but somewhat unglued her sense of identity, which is something that's always part of the process of soul initiation. It begins with a dying to who we thought we were. And we don't die to our beliefs about ourselves simply by deciding to do so, that we need practices of various sorts that are kind of fierce, that destabilize our sense of identity. And for Joanna, her Buddhist practice was that, and it is for many people. And sometime in this process of her deepening into her Buddhist contemplative practice, she had a vision, and the vision was something like this, that she had a vision of a stone bridge, and she recognized that her destiny in her life was to become one stone in that bridge. She says, just one, well, that's enough. And it's a bridge connecting two things. She became aware that the bridge was connecting the traditions, the spiritual traditions of the East with the, I think she might have said, the intellectual traditions of the West, and that her destiny was in part to make a bridge between those two. And if you know of her life, that's in many ways what she has done. So it's that image of a stone and a bridge. That's, you could say, that was at least part of the truth, or one of the truths at the center of the image she was born with, stone and a bridge. It didn't tell her what social role or vocational role to take. And she was very, in her late 30s, she was very much working with raising her family, and she really hadn't started what we would call in the West a career. So she wondered at that time of her vision whether she would become a librarian, one of her guesses, or a professor at a university. She became neither, as it turned out. She became who we now know as Joanna Macy. So that's an example. Here's another one of my favorites. It's from a poet, the great Irish poet, William Butler Yeats. He had a vision in his late 20s. I don't know if his biographers referred to it that way, but I feel that he glimpsed his mythopoetic identity and wrote a poem about it. which is one of his famous poems called Song of Wandering Angus. Anyone know that one? Song of Wandering Angus. He wrote it in his late 20s, which is a common time to have visions for one's life, late 20s. And it's a remarkable poem for a number of reasons. One is that it has three stanzas, and the three stanzas pretty much tell you what the nature of the journey to soul is, the three phases of the journey. We often say it's a U-shaped journey. It's a downward journey to the underworld. And the first phase of the journey is dying to who we thought we were and what we thought the world was and what life was about. That's a severance from the world we had been living and our identity. And the second phase is a mystical encounter with the, let's call it the truth at the center of the image we were born with. And then the final phase is a return to our the everyday world with a boon for our people, the return. And the boon is our way of participating in the world that we were born to engage in. And if we do, what we do will help change the world. So three stanzas. Here we go. It's not too long of a poem. I went out to the hazel wood because a fire was in my head. Okay, I'll help you out here. The fire was in his head. I mean, all the thoughts he had about who he was and what life was about just up in flames. Okay, I went out to the hazel wood. The hazel wood, of course, is a magical place in Irish lore. I went out to the hazel wood because a fire was in my head and cut and peeled a hazel wand and hooked a berry to a thread. And when white moths were on the wing and moth-like stars were flickering out, I dropped the berry in a stream and caught and caught and caught a little silver trout. Okay, so that's the descent. And they're filming this tonight, and I thought I'd want to keep them awake by moving around a lot. So, okay, back to the poem. The second stanza is the underworld mystical encounter time. When I had laid it on the floor, the trout, when I had laid it on the floor, I went to blow the fire aflame, but something rustled on the floor, and someone called me by my name. It, the trout, it had become a glimmering girl with apple blossom in her hair, who called me by my name and ran and faded through the brightening air. Okay, that was his mystical encounter. He thought he had caught a fish and that was going to help the fire in his head, but no. Whatever we think we catch in the first phase actually catches us in the second stage. And he got caught by this glimmering girl. The Jungians would say his anima. He got caught by her calling him by his name. And it wasn't William or Billy. It was some mystical name that he maybe tells us in the poem or maybe he doesn't. Third stanza, the return. Remember, he's 28 when he wrote this. Sorry. He's 28 when he wrote this, but this third stanza is as if he's writing it at the very end of his life. Though I am old with wandering through hollow lands and hilly lands, I will find out where she has gone. Though I'm old with wandering through hollow lands and hilly lands, I will find out where she has gone and kiss her lips and hold her hand and walk among long dappled grass and pluck till time and times are done, the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun. So I think he, but Yeats, he's telling us here at age 28, what my life is about and will be about is plucking the silver apples of the moon and the golden apples of the sun. And for those of you who know about Yeats's life, that turned out to be what his life was about, as expressed through symbol and archetype and image and dream and metaphor. Many of his poems are playing with the relationship between the sun and the moon as symbols, among other things, of the masculine and the feminine. And the last book he wrote in the 70s was actually a book about the phases of the moon called, the book is called A Vision. And I actually studied that book with one of my first in-person live spiritual teachers when I was in my 20s. Okay. Last example is from me. It's a short form. Those of you who've read Soulcraft, it's the preface to Soulcraft, and if you want the long version, you could get a hold of Soulcraft. And this it was also in my late 20s, 29, 30 actually. When I was in my late 20s, I was a professor of psychology, a research psychologist studying non-ordinary states of consciousness. And very engaged in that. It was very interesting work to me, and I was doing well. I was publishing in the best journals and so forth. And through a series of experiences, one in particular on a mountaintop in the Adirondacks in New York State, I was minding my own business, doing a solo winter ascent of a little peak there, and got to the top and realized the life I was living was not my own, despite being so successful at it. And it was a tremendous, many of you, maybe all of you, have had an experience like that sometime in your life, and there's this weird combination experience of emotional experience of grief and hope at the same time, and they're equally strong. Grief for not having lived my life as fully as I could have, and hope that there's some possibility, but I have to give up everything that I've known to get there. So I came down off that mountain, and I resigned my position and as a professor in New York State, and make a long story a little bit shorter. About a year later, I went out to enact my own first vision fast, because during that year, I had met my teachers, Stephen Foster and Meredith Little, the two people who have, from the Bay Area, who were the most, the primary people bringing the pan-cultural vision fast experience back to contemporary Western culture. And based on their instruction, I took myself out into the mountains of northern Colorado for 5 days and fasted for 4 days and nights in the traditional way. Traditional meaning fasted for 4 days and nights alone and exposed to the forms and forces of the wild world. And during that time, I was at a mountain lake. I got to know the residents of that area fairly well. The little furry, friendly creatures, the pikas, and the lake, the beavers of the lake, and this one particular spruce tree was really speaking to me. And in most circles in the Western world, you say something like that, and people think you're a little bit odd. But you guys probably understand what I'm talking about. And especially after 4 days of fasting and being alone, having a conversation with a tree is the most obvious thing in the world to do. And this tree had become a monk. And when I first, on the third day, when I realized it was a monk, I was so embarrassed that it took me 3 days to recognize. I apologized. And the monk was teaching me things that are kind of difficult to put into words, but I tried in the preface to Soulcraft. And at one point, the beaver, not the beaver, the tree, the monk, made a gesture with one of its branches and brought my attention to the left, where there was a large yellow butterfly flying my way, and it brushed my cheek, actually touched my cheek, and said the words, cocoon weaver, when it went by. And luckily, I was able to recognize that I had just had a numinous experience. And I thought I was having them for 4 days already, and I was. But an encounter with our soul, with an image that has something, some strong resonance with our soul, is something that's not merely an interesting intellectual idea. It strikes at the very core, like lightning. When it happens, we feel we've been changed alchemically. And that was my experience. And I had no idea what it meant, no idea. I just knew that this, that my being able to live and the image of weaving cocoons meant everything for any hope of participating, of my participating in the world and any hope of fulfillment. So I have been apprenticed to that image and a few other images since then. So let me remind you of the story of the butterfly. You probably all know this. There's three stages, I think, to the butterfly's life. There's the larval stage, and then there's the caterpillar stage, and then there's the butterfly. And to get, caterpillar to butterfly is at least analogous to adolescent to adult. And to make that transition, the caterpillar, as you know, has to suffer the complete annihilation of its caterpillarhood, or ness. It finds itself kind of drunkenly one day, after it's molted, by the way, several times. I think different species molt a number of different times, but say moth or butterfly, they go through, you know, five or six phases of being an adolescent, and they lose their skin and they grow another caterpillar skin. And that's the kind of change that we specialize in Western contemporary mainstream culture. We do these makeovers from caterpillar A to caterpillar B. And we sometimes we think that's becoming an adult, but it's actually becoming another caterpillar. So at some point, the caterpillar finds itself drunkenly spinning this moth, caterpillars anyways, this cocoon. And it doesn't even know why we can project and imagine. It doesn't know why it's doing it. And if it did, it would be crazy to do it. And in that cocoon, it enters the cocoon and it turns into liquid, this caterpillar soup. And there are these cells that have been in the caterpillar all along called, biologists call them imaginal cells. Fantastic word. Imaginal for a biologist has to do with the imago, which is the, is that the caterpillar? Or is it the adult? Maybe so. But these cells that know how to turn a caterpillar into a butterfly, and it takes that soup and it rearranges the same cells, and out comes a butterfly. So that's a great analogy, the caterpillar to butterfly, for the process of soul initiation. As far as we know, all the other species go through that kind of transformation from adolescent to adult just by virtue of, by gift of genetics. In fact, 95% of species don't even need parents except to be birthed, conceived and birthed, to become an adult. The only species are mammals and birds that appear to need what we might call culture, parents, family, and so on, to help them into adulthood. We humans not only need that, but we need these special ceremonies or practices, unless we get really lucky. Most people need the practices that are offered by elders or the adult initiators to go through this soul initiation process, where no human in the right mind would go into a cocoon to become dissolved. But the elders recognize that the health of the culture depends on that. And so everything is arranged so that the elders will recognize a young person, in a healthy culture it's a young person, maybe in their mid-teens, who is ready to go into the cocoon. And when a person is ready, there's this really, really deep longing. And the elders recognize the longing and take advantage of that poor young person and bring them into the initiatory process. All of us have experienced that longing, and most of us weren't met by elders, which are, true elders are relatively rare in the Western world. It's, true adults are relatively rare. Okay. We all long for our lives to matter. We all long to participate in the world in our unique way. We all long to fall in love with the world in a way that only we can. But the process, as I say, involves this three-phase. It's a three-phase process. It begins with dying. And most of us would say, I'll skip the dying part, thank you, and just have the rebirth. And that's one reason why we need the practices and the elders and the initiators to hold the space. I will say that at Animus, we've been held in this process of beginning to reinvent a contemporary Western process of initiation. We've been held and fed by so many people and traditions, by many teachers, elders, colleagues, by the best of Western depth psychology, by mythologies from all over the world, by our own extended wilderness experiences and wanderings, by the teachings from some indigenous traditions, by Western mystery schools, and certainly by the thousands of participants in our offerings. And we're still stumbling our way through, doing our best. So what I've been speaking about so far, in some ways, are really the topics of my first two books. And now I'm reminded that I was invited here to talk about the third book, Wild Mind. So let me tell you a little bit about that. Back in the 80s, I assumed that everyone who showed up to our Animus offerings were ready for the descent to soul, for the soul initiation process. But it turned out that less than half were actually ready. The others were not prepared for the descent to soul. And it seemed that they weren't prepared because there was there needed to be some foundation of emotional healing. Now, not to imply that anybody that I've ever met, certainly including myself, has ever completely done with our emotional healing. I don't think anybody has ever done. But there's some foundational amount of our healing that seems to be necessary before we're really psychologically and spiritually prepared for the descent. So we started in the 80s looking at this and noticing what the kind of places where people would get stuck as the descent was starting. And they got stuck in all the ways that Western psychology talks about how we get stuck. Wounded parts show up, our inner critic shows up, our addicts flare, our addictions flare up in big ways. We get mugged all of a sudden by our own shadow, and these are just things that happen to all of us. But especially when we're about to go through some fundamental change, all of these wounded parts show up to protect us from our own destiny. Because it is very risky to them, to our wounded parts. So we started developing practices. About half of us guides at Animus were therapists and half of us weren't, but we didn't want to be doing therapy in our ceremonial work. And so we started developing practices where we could coach people to our participants to heal themselves. Again, one of those wild ideas that would be possible for a lot of people. And I think people who are really called to the journey to soul can heal themselves with some coaching. And so we were working for years about how to best do this. And we started discovering that there are what we now call the four facets of our wholeness, of our human wholeness. The four facets of what I call the self, capital S. It's a similar way that Carl Jung used the word self, but not quite the same. That each of us is born with four bundles of resources that we are gifted by virtue of being born human. These four magnificent jeweled bundles of resources that unless, if we don't learn to cultivate them, we never really have much access to them. But they're waiting there in each one of us. It's one way we're all the same. Like our soul identity is quite unique, but the self is very similar from one person to another. And what we started to do is map our wholeness onto that template that you find in cultures all over the world, which is the template of the four cardinal directions. Or a larger template is actually the seven directions if you include up and down and center. And so we began mapping the human psyche onto the seven directions, which to my knowledge hadn't been done before. It probably has, but I wasn't aware of it. So, and we used the horizontal direction to map the self, our wholeness. And one thing we started to discover was that these four facets of wholeness are pretty much not anywhere in mainstream Western psychology. Our wholeness, our magnificence is not there. Western psychology is strong on what's wrong. And it helps to be able to say how our psyches can go wrong. But it helps even more to say what are our magnificent resources. So, and as you know, Western psychology came out of the medical model. And it was a disease, illness-oriented model, and the goal initially, and maybe still to some degree, is to be able to map the kinds of psychological diseases we can have. And the goal is to remove the symptoms, simplifying. And what my colleagues and I have come to believe is that, no, the goal in growing whole is to cultivate our wholeness. What an idea. It's first and foremost to cultivate our wholeness. And the way that we can heal ourselves, or even the way we can take advantage, the best advantage of help to heal ourselves, is first by cultivating the four facets of our wholeness, and then embracing our wounded parts. And because our wounded parts aren't just wounded, they actually have all kinds of things to teach us and to ways of participating in our lives in a good way. So our emphasis the last 15 years or so in this foundational work to help people prepare for the descent is helping them cultivate the four facets of their wholeness. And that's the map that's in Wild Mind, the four facets of wholeness. I'll just take a few moments to name those four facets. Again, they're mapped onto the four cardinal directions. In the north, these will be familiar to you. You find these in mythologies all over the world, including Western mythologies. There's just not so much in Western psychology, although Jungians have done, I think, a really good job at it, but they didn't have this pattern language of the four directions. I mean, they did, but they didn't map the psyche onto the four directions. And when we do, we start discovering all kinds of things. It just kind of comes out of the woodwork of the map. So in the north, we have what we call the nurturing generative adult. Nurturing, that part of us that's capable of taking care of ourselves, helping ourselves grow, helping others grow, and also, of course, very importantly, nurturing and caring for the larger environment from which we come, from which we have sprung, that sustains us, and that, as we know, we are mortally harming in industrial growth society. You know all about that story. And generative means ability to generate, to get things done, and in particular, to embody, to live the life of our souls, to participate in the world, to help grow or repair a healthy culture. That's the north aspect. North facet of ourself. In the book, if you read it, you'll find what that has to do with North and the qualities of the natural world we encounter in the North, in the Northern Hemisphere, or it's the South in the Southern Hemisphere. So the East facet of the self, I call the innocent sage. The slash is because it's paradoxical. How can anything be both innocent and wise? Well, actually, it's not hard at all. Those two are actually very similar, innocence and wisdom. They both have to do with our purity, with purity, incorruptibility, with seeing the world simply, big picture, with our ability to lighten up. Wisdom, importantly, contrasted with knowledge. knowledge is more in the north, wisdom resonates more in the east. So the archetypes of the east are the innocent, the sage, but also the trickster. We each have a trickster part of ourselves that can help us get over ourselves and stop taking yourself so seriously. I'm one of those people who tends to take myself way too seriously. And so my trickster says things like, when you do public talks, show up wearing underwear on your head, which I haven't tried yet. But the sacred fool is another archetype of the East. In the South is what I call the wild indigenous one. And this is the part of ourselves that recognize that we are from Earth. I am from Earth. And that I am related to all the other species. And I have a place I'm kin also with all the habitat. And I love being embodied as an animal and having this animal body. And the wild indigenous one is erotic, sexual, sensual, very emotional, thinks every emotion is the greatest experience you could have. There's no such thing as a toxic emotion to our wild indigenous one. Everyone feels great in the body. Fear, all right. Shame, good. Learned something important. Thank you very much. And this South aspect is particularly dangerous to Western culture, because if all of us were to have been, if all of us were supported by our parents and teachers and priests and so on to embody our wild indigenous aspects, we would, of course, have this natural allurement to the wider, wilder world, and we'd all experience our kinship with everything, our interdependency. We'd be having our love affair with everything. And we wouldn't, there'd be at least a large minority of us that would say no to the destruction of our world. So Western, to get to the culture we had to have educational and religious systems that suppressed our cultivation of that South aspect. Finally, the West, most mysterious, sunset place. The West I call the Muse Beloved. That's Muse-Beloved. The Muse, of course, is our deep imagination. That imagination that's not in the ego's control, that those images, those knowings that well up from the depths of our own psyche and suggest very wild things for our lives. And so the West is also the change place, or the transformation place. It's that part of ourselves that loves to die to whatever we thought was true in our life. And in the caterpillar years, it loves to go through molts. And when it's time to become a butterfly, it loves, says, yeah, cocoon, all right. Soup time, great, sign me up. So the West, the Muse Beloved, is in really good speaking terms with death. Thinks death is one of the coolest aspects of life, not opposite to life. And the cryptic and the crypt are yummy places to the West. And the other half of its name, the Beloved, refers to the inner Beloved, which is, you could say, is the Beloved of soul, or you could say it's our other half. In some circles, you'd say it's the other gender of ourselves. So if we're a masculine person, whether in a female or a male body, if we're very masculine, the West we experience is very feminine. And it's actually the part of ourselves that we're romantically longing for. And we tend to project that part of ourselves onto other humans without realizing we're doing that, and thinking that he or she, that other person, is my other half, and I won't be whole till I find him, her. And then I do find him, her, he or she turns out to be not exactly what I was expecting. And it's his, her fault, not mine. And next romance, I'll get better at, or luckier. And all the time we don't realize, because we're not told this in mainstream Western world, that what we're longing for is our inner other half, which is in the West. Okay, so those are the four facets. That was a very quick tour. Sorry for the speed. And with the four facets, we can embrace our wounded parts, like the inner critic, our inner wounded children, our addicts, and also our shadow aspects. And it's, there seems to be this principle that each one is, of us is born with the capacity to cultivate one of our four facets of wholeness easiest. You might say some of us are North people, some South people, some East, some West people. But we even need help cultivating that aspect of our wholeness. But for some, it's easiest. And the principle seems to be that whichever facet of wholeness is easiest for us, the one on the opposite side of the circle is most difficult, seems most strange. We'll all say it, if you read the book, I hope you'll have the experience when you read one of the four facets that you'll say to yourself, I don't got that. I was dealt three cards, not four. That's not me. There's no way. Other people, sure, but not me. And that's the way it seems like it's part of the being a human game, how it's worked out. But it turns out that most foreign facet of wholeness is the one we most need in order to fully embody our destiny in this lifetime. So what I'd like to do is end with one last poem. And this one is one of the poems of my outer beloved, Janine Marie Haugen, who's here tonight. And she told me recently she's not done with this poem yet. And I remembered what another poet friend of mine told me. She said, there's no such thing as a completed poem. Poems are never finished, they're only abandoned. So this is a not yet abandoned poem. Janine's, it's called At Nepenthe's Threshold. At Nepenthe's Threshold. And she reminds us that Nepenthe in Greek literature is a potion that magically quells sorrow. Sometimes called a drug of forgetfulness. And she also wants to remind us that Nepenthe is also a restaurant on the Big Sur coast. Anybody ever been to Nepenthe? It's this wild stretch of coast. It is a gorgeous spot, and it's an amazing restaurant, actually. And attached to the restaurant is an adjacent fine shop that has imports and just really, really neat stuff. And as Janine says, that this fine shop, it's, I think it's called the Phoenix Shop, it beckons both purposeful and unwary travelers. So in truth of an advertisement, when Janine and I guide programs at Esalen a lot, and when we're on our way down the Big Sur coast to Esalen, we always stop at Nepenthe's and the Phoenix Shop. So, just so you don't think we're immune to potions, magical potions. So here it is, at Nepenthe's Threshold. The soul is a mad poet. The soul is a mad poet accosting you on your hurried way across the door sill of the handsome shop where your pocketbook is full and your desire endless. The soul is a mad poet, accosting you on your hurried way across the door sill of a handsome shop while your pocketbook is full and your desire endless. The soul is a mad poet, frightening, curious, beckoning. His hair an unruly star nest, his eyes rapt and flaming, a wildfire, you flee in horror of such burning, secure in the cool, placid comfort you have wrapped around your life. The soul is a mad poet with songbirds flying from his mouth, his cape woven of comets, rough bark and fur. Sing with me, he calls. Mad poet, and you nearly stumble as you hurry through Nepenthe's door, get through there as fast as you can, holding your ears closed against the voice daring you to speak that language. At Nepenthes, it is said, you can obliterate all grief, as if pretty things are your only longing, as if pretty things are your only longing. The soul is a mad poet who closes his songbird mouth and turns his face away when you leave the Penthe, your pocketbook empty, arms heavy with pretty bags stuffed full of insatiable desire. The soul is a mad poet who turns away, but not before you see that he is weeping, weeping for you, for your cool comfort, for your bags full of nothing. How dare you, you shout. No one weeps for me. I have everything. But your bags crumble to ash in your tight fingers, and he doesn't look back. He is loping, his cape whirling behind him like a wind-filled mane, like a comet's tail, trailing a faint symphony of wolves and loons, haunting ululations that uncage every grieving cry your own throat before this moment refused. The pain is terrible. Like the sharp pricking of numb extremities exposed to sudden heat, your own cries pierce and shake you from waking sleep, shred the shroud of cool comfort, rupture the hypnotic cultural narcosis. Still, you could stop the sting of awakening. You could sip once more from the potion that deadens all sorrow, all hunger for blazing life. You could forget the one who has come for you from a free-voiced land where nothing is only partially alive. You could forget the one who may never find your tracks again. You could. Yes, you wail, the moment he vanishes. I will sing. I will sing. Not at first recognizing the mad voice as your own, tasting the sweet ache in your opening throat, the forgotten language warbling over your tongue. Yes, you howl and run, racing, chasing him toward the horizon, your pretty bags forgotten, your skin tingling, senses raw and reaching. Forget the old directions. Forget the old directions. There is a wilder place where mad poets, tricksters, wanderers, visionaries, and free-voiced people are dreaming together and sorrowing and howling forth a new life. Forget the old directions. There is a wilder place where mad poets, tricksters, wanderers, visionaries, and free-voiced people are dreaming together and sorrowing and howling forth a new life. It is not far. It's not far. There is a faint trail. Sniff the air. Sniff the air. Listen for grief cries and howling laughter. Listen for calling songs. Watch for offerings of wild prayers. Everything, everything depends on this. Find the others. The moss, cactus, coyote, and stone will show their true faces when you begin to sing. Listen for calling songs. Watch for offerings of wild prayers. Everything depends on this. Find the others. The moss, cactus, coyote, and stone will show their true faces when you begin to sing. At Nepenthes Threshold, Janine Marie Haugen. That's the end of my talk. Thank you very much.
So we'd like to invite some questions or comments.
Did you also map the horizontal axis as well? I mean the vertical axis.
Good question, yes. Very important point, actually. So on the in the upper direction is what we might call spirit, or the non-dual, or the great mystery. Excuse me, in some traditions, God. So the upper direction, or the upper world, embodies our relationship with the divine, with the universal, with the ways in which our own consciousness is not only resonant with, but one with the great vast imagination that is unfolding as the cosmos. And in the downward direction is soul. Again, something much deeper than personality. It's what is most unique about not only humans, but anything. Everything has a soul aspect in this sense of soul. Everything has a unique place in the world. And everything in the world, except for humans as far as we know, just naturally takes its unique place. But we humans, because we have egos, which is not a problem. Immature egos are a problem. Mature egos are our gift to the world. It's because we have egos, a part of ourselves separated off from the rest of our psyche, that we're actually capable of not taking our true place. And we need to go through these initiatory processes to discover what our true place is, and that's the descent to soul. And so you can call the vertical axis the spiritual or the transpersonal axis, spirit up, soul down. And from this perspective, all full spiritualities have both an upper world aspect and an underworld aspect. And in contemporary Western culture, there's either no true spirituality at all, or if there tend to be upper world spiritualities without the underworld part. It's as if the underworld part has been forgotten or cut off. But either form of spirituality, it seems to me, is somewhat dangerous without the other, without its complement. And I won't take the time now to go into what those dangers are, but you can probably feel into them anyways. And in the middle of the vertical axis is, that's where the ego is. The ego is simply the part of ourselves that's conscious of ourselves in the world. And so in the wild mind, okay, the goal of personal development, is essence, is having access to all four facets of our wholeness, and access to spirit, conscious access, and conscious access to soul. And that's what I call a three-dimensional ego. A fully healthy human ego is three-dimensional in that sense.
Thank you. This is an amazing talk. So you talked about early on in your career that you were a teacher and a psychologist around altered states. And then you had this epiphany or this vision, and then you shifted into this other path of study in a way. And I'm just wondering, what did you think that was? How do you think that fit into what you arrived at? Those altered states. What did you learn about those, and how did that inform, you know, where you are now?
The altered states that I was studying is what you're asking about.
That you were teaching about early on, that you said,
yeah,
that when you were a teacher, you were studying and teaching about altered states of consciousness.
Yes.
And
how does that fit in?
How does that inform, like, where you've landed right now?
Yeah, good. Great question. The process of soul discovery requires us to shift consciousness. It requires a certain kind of flexibility in our ability to move to different psycho-spiritual places from which to experience ourselves and the world. If we're always in one place, even if it's a good place, it's like not having stereoscopic vision or something. We can't really see things in its depth. And so non-ordinary states are totally natural. I mean, in a group like this, I probably don't need to tell you this. They're totally natural to being human. I mean, obviously we dream every night. But visionary states, all healthy cultures have ways of altering consciousness. Every healthy teenager wants to alter his or her consciousness. Children don't want to because they just do it naturally. But once after puberty, we want to alter our consciousness. I'm not talking about getting drunk or altering a consciousness that in a way that suppresses our aliveness, but the kinds of shifts in consciousness that allow us to experience the world more fully as the magical, wondrous place that it is. So one thing we find cross-culturally in all technologies for soul initiation are techniques for altering consciousness. In many cultures, there are entheogens, psychoactive substances. In many other cultures, there aren't. You don't need them. And when you do have them, they're part of ceremonies, and the rest of the ceremony is as important as the substance. And well, that's a whole long topic. But I'm just reminded now, I also wanted to say that the work we do at Animus, it's important to understand it's not rites of passage. In the last 30, 40, 50 years, we've learned such wonderful things about rites of passage and the importance of ceremonies that help us move from one major stage of life to the next. But actually, the rites of passages are designed for people who are already in a passage. Rites of passage don't cause passages. They celebrate passages that are already happening, and they help people adapt to a whole new consciousness and a whole new world that takes place because of the passage. We've tended to think in the last 30 years or so that rites of passage create passages. They don't. What creates a passage is attending to the developmental tasks of the stage you're in. And once you've done enough of that work, then life or mystery moves you, and the rite of passage celebrates it, lets everybody in the community know that that's happened, and it helps you adapt to a very, very different way of being in the world. So the work we do at Animus is actually not rites of passage. It's a passage is an event. What we're working with is a process that takes several months at least and or several years. It doesn't mean we don't have programs that are several years long. Most of the people who come to our programs and who are ready, who are going through the soul initiation process, they've already been in it for quite some time. Others haven't been in it at all, and they start it, like the first time they do some work with us. And then it might be months or years of going through this initiatory process. It's just always a little bit disappointing to hear someone say that it's not a weekend workshop, initiatory processes. It's not even a week long. It's the time, that mystery has its timing on that. Okay. Hi, Catherine.
I had kind of a light bulb go on tonight listening to you, which is what strikes me as perhaps paradoxical, but then not, relationship between becoming an individual and being, or let me see how to put this into words. I'm realizing there's a relationship between becoming an individual and being of service to the community, that the individual part has to happen first before we can actually serve community. And I was wondering if perhaps so many of the efforts that are being attempted now to create community in a lot of different ways aren't working because we haven't fully become individuals. And I was wondering if you could just say something about that.
More than I agree. Yeah. Yeah, that, I think that's very much true. We have this kind of, this very adolescent cult of individuality. And we mean like becoming a caterpillar with its own unique wardrobe, something like that. And that's our contemporary Western adolescent version of individuality. And from that perspective, we could say the problem is individuality. It's all about me. But that's the deeper individuality, which Catherine was speaking to, is something else. When we the deeper individuality is our soul, our underworld rooted individuality. And in fact, what I believe, and I've found myself saying for years, is that when someone goes through the soul initiation process, well, the outcome, by the way, is true adulthood. That's how one gets to what healthy cultures call true adulthood, is finding out what you, the truth at the center of the image you were born with. And when you know what that is and you begin to live it into the world, you begin to embody it through one or more cultural delivery systems. For example, I'm a vision fast guide and a soul craft guide and a psychologist and a author. And those are cultural delivery systems, in my case, for weaving cocoons, which is a type of stirring up trouble. I believe when anybody has been initiated and is doing their adult soul work, that, without trying to, that automatically creates community. Because when we're doing our soul work, we are creating a field, you might say, that feels right. It feels right to others. It might also feel dangerous, but it feels right to others. There's something going on there that I want to be part of, I want to join in on, either because I've been initiated myself or I haven't, either way. Another way to say this is to ask the question, where does healthy culture come from? Where does healthy, mature culture come from? Well, where did it originally come from? It didn't come from blue ribbon panels of primates deciding how to create a healthy human culture. It came from nature. That's where everything comes from. It comes from our own wildness. And our soul is part of nature. Our soul is a wild part of nature. And when we're living our souls, we create what I call delivery systems, which are cultural forms for bringing a mysterious soul gift into the world. And so these are healthy, soul-rooted social practices that we create as initiated adults. And what is culture? Culture or community? It's a set of, more complicated than this, but it essentially is a set of cultural practices, social practices, through which we do life together. Where do those social practices come from? The healthy, sustainable, life-enhancing ones come from the soul. And so that's where true community comes from. And as Catherine was saying, we have to become true individuals in the soul-initiated sense to create culture. And if we're in the situation we're in now, which is not the beginning of the human story, but some 50 or 100,000 years since, at least that many years, how do we reinvent healthy culture? You can't put together a blue ribbon panel of experts to do it. You could, but it won't be a healthy culture. It takes generations of people, of a society with enough adults and true elders to be interacting and living life in a way that creates a truly mature culture. So we're probably several generations short of that. But between now and then, what we need is a really healthy adolescent culture, which we don't have yet. And one way to define a healthy adolescent culture, it's one that honors the environment that sustains it. Any teenager, healthy teenager, understands that. And so that's what we have to do in the next 20, 30, 40 years. Did I answer your question? Okay, thanks.
I bought your book and started reading the introduction. And I came across a sentence that said, reclaiming these essential human capacities of the self ought to be the highest priority in psychology, education, religion, medicine, and leadership development. And I'm wondering if you have had experience bringing this into those areas, or if you've had, what kind of experience you've had with professionals in those areas coming to you and wanting to make it a priority, or perhaps they've rejected it wholeheartedly. What has been your experience with these fields?
We do in our our Animus programs. We have professionals in all those fields who are coming to us, and we're doing our best to infect them and learn from them and trade notes about how to do education and religion or spirituality well, in a more whole way. Yeah, and we hope to be doing more of that. Yeah, especially with this new book out.
Is the soul initiation something that you do once in life?
Yes. However, there's two terms to contrast. One is soul initiation. It's a process of many years, or months at least. And the other one is soul encounter. A soul encounter is a term I use for an experience where you glimpse something about the mystery you were born with, the truth at the center of the image you were born with. Another favorite phrase from David White is, the shape that waits in the seed of you to grow and spread its branches against a future sky. Isn't that lovely? The shape that waits in the seed of you to grow and spread its branches against a future sky. And if we get through the soul initiation process, we will have had at least one soul encounter. And in my second book, Nature and the Human Soul, is a developmental model of ecocentric or soul-centric human development as found in, at least theoretically, in any healthy culture. So it's on the archetypal level and the deep structure level. There's 8 stages of human development in this model, and the 4th stage is the cocoon stage. And the soul encounters usually start for almost everybody in that 4th stage. It's the stage that maybe only 20% of Westerners ever reach. But you can have more than one soul encounter in that stage, and people often have soul encounters in the next stage. So the 5th stage, which is I call the apprentice at the wellspring, the first stage of adulthood. And soul encounters can happen after that as well. And sometimes people have soul encounters in early adolescence or childhood, but they don't know what to do with it until later. So, but the soul initiation process is, I understand it as a happens once, and it ends with the life passage of soul initiation. And if one's lucky, there's a community around you that can create for you a rite of passage for soul initiation to help you get oriented toward this terrible, wondrous thing that has just happened to you. But it only happens once because, see, you make a promise it would kill you to break. The only way to go back is to kill yourself first, so you don't.
Bill, you've made many references to a healthy culture or healthy cultures and practices. Could you give some specific examples of cultures that you feel that way about?
No.
Okay.
For two reasons. I have a longer answer, actually. One is that Western civilization has been eradicating them for 10,000 years now. And there's this wonderful book written by a man named Andrew Schmuckler, great last name, called The Parable of the Tribes, in which he describes what happens when you have a dominator society around healthy cultures. The healthy cultures are undermined or eliminated one way or another. And the only way you can survive in a world like that as a culture is to go someplace where they can't find you, where the dominator people can't find you. And what has happened in the 20th century was that Western civilization has gotten everywhere, so there's no place left to hide. And so most all cultures have been eliminated, healthy cultures have been eliminated by either a patho-adolescent religious missionary work or corporate or military or resource extraction. But if we could, and I'm not saying whether I could or not name some healthy cultures, none of us would want to even speak their names healthy company, because that's maybe going too far. But the point is we want them to stay hidden as long as possible. But we have stories of recently healthy cultures that have been maybe not destroyed. One is Maladoma Somme's books about the Dagara people in West Africa. And it seems that there's reason to say that they are still culturally intact in many ways. And then we have Martine Prechtel's books about the Tutuhil Maya people in Guatemala, who perhaps were pretty much destroyed in the 80s, thanks to the the former president of Guatemala, who recently got found guilty of genocide and then was let off the hook by the government. But so that's why they're hard to name. I live in the American Southwest, and I've visited the Hopi people several times, especially in the 80s. And to me, they're very much culturally intact still, despite being surrounded by Western culture.
I wonder if you can address how to hold with love the perfection of life and the unity of life and the sacred outrage and activism that our time seemed to call forth.
How do you hold love and anger at the same time?
Well, not anger.
Outrage.
So much sacred outrage.
Yeah.
It's an authentic, I believe, response to our one body being assaulted.
Yeah.
In the midst of the incredible, glorious perfection holding all chaos, how to be both and act in a way that addresses those two.
That's a great question. I don't know if I have a good answer. The main thing that comes to mind is, how can we not? How can we not be outraged? And how can we not be in love with the world? How can our love for the world not leave us, among other things, outraged about the destruction of life? That's part of our loving. I'm thinking of my teacher, Joanna Macy, who probably have a much better answer than me on this, but one thing I learned from her is, and she was partly speaking, at least partly, from the Buddhist perspective, and she said, "Oh, Bill, anger and hatred are very, very different things. The Buddha did not say, don't be angry. He said, hatred is a problem, among other things. But there's sacred anger, and Joanna told me about one of the Buddhist gods who holds, does anybody know who that is? Who holds the sacred anger, at least one of them that holds that sacred anger. And it's part of our passion for the world. And it motivates us not to harm anything or anybody, but it motivates us to support, to hold, to champion life, to sustain and enhance life. Thank you for that question. And thank you all for...
Bill, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.